Mr. Watkins, Reel 3. We're talking about your time at effectively Butlins, Pafeli, HMS Glendower.
Yeah.
Now, what other types of training did you have?
Well, we did have some signal training, and I got quite proficient at sending and receiving Morse.
Did your sort of private interest before everything started, did that give you an advantage, or did you have to relearn in the naval manner?
No, I think it gave me an advantage. I knew the Morse codes, you know, like the alphabet. Stays there in your mind. In fact, I find that even today, if I'm bored on an underground station or a train, I'll start reading the ads to myself in Morse. Which is a silly thing to do, but it's part of the time.
How did they train you in Morse? What was the setup?
You just had to learn the Morse code. You know, you'd be given the Morse code on a piece of paper and expected in half an hour to be able to say what letters were in, you know, Dardy. A is the da, B, da, did it, C, da, did it, D, da, did it, and so on. And you learn it off and you start using it. And you gradually get.
Would you have a sender? Would they have a training set up?
We were in separate rooms and we used to send messages to each other. And also we had to learn semaphore, of course, flags, A, B, C, D, E, F, G. You learn it all and it sticks after a while if you've done it for a week or two.
What about lamp work?
Yes. All this lamps we used to send. Yes, that was.
Did they all use a semaphore's a different code? Did the oldest use Morse?
Oh yes, yeah. Well, the oldest was just a lamp with a mirror behind it. You tilted the mirror, and that was the most effective thing at sea.
But semaphore was a different code, was it?
Semaphore was flags. Yes, it used. You have to see it written down. You know, you have two flags. And they're put in different positions. That's the sort of standby position. You cross them in front of you. And then A is the right hand, like that, in a low position. B, there, C, D. And it goes round the clock. It's like the hand of a clock in different positions to denote a letter. But they get quite quick at it. You know, you see, they used to call them bunting tossers. A bunting tosser in full flow, and these arms would be flying all over the place, you know, to get the message through.
And how far did you go with this? Because you weren't actually trained as a signal rater at the time, were you?
No, but I was efficient enough to be able to read Morse messages when I was later on board ship,
And what other types of training did you get? Any other specialist training?
The only thing that sticks in my mind was rather horrible. They had a special room there, and you had to wear your gas mask. We all make gas masks, service-type gas masks. And you had to put your gas mask on and go in this room, and then they put a couple of cylinders of tear gas in. And you had to stay in there for, I believe it was about 3 minutes. And then for the last 30 seconds, they made you take the mask off, and you had to stay in there for 30 seconds in tear gas. And that was pretty awful because, you know, a lot of people didn't realise what it was going to do to them, and they only let us out after 30 seconds, and they were choking and spluttering, and it was pretty grim. And then within 5 minutes of going through that experience, they made us run all around the perimeter of the camp, which was a good mile, in, you know, all that kit. And it was pretty grim, but I suppose they thought it was necessary to give you some insight into what could happen, you know, if you had a gas attack, but fortunately the gas mask was never used.
What about guard duties? Or fire watching? Not there?
No, I did fire watching when I was a civilian at the factory at Dunstable. We used to be paid 3 shillings a night for fire watching there.
Well, let's drop that in here. What did you have to do?
Well, we had to sleep in a separate room that they had, and there were rats running around in it. We found that after we were there a few nights. And you had to take it in turns to do an hour's watching during the night. You take, they had bunks in there, and you draw lots, I think, for what hour you did from 10 o'clock at night right through to 8 o'clock the following morning doing an hour's watching. And you had to patrol the factory. And it was very expensive. They had railway siding running into that factory at Dunstable. It was very well planned. But the huge, it was all on one story, only the offices were two stories, and the rest of the factory was all one story, spread over acres of ground. at the back of Dunstable. Whether it's still there, I don't know.
So you just, what did you do exactly?
You just walked around different parts of the factory. I think there were probably four of you on duty. There were a lot of us there. And I think four of us were woken to do the hour together. We used to take different sections of the factory to patrol in case there was any incendiaries or bombs dropping or anything.
And what were you to do, what equipment did you have if you found
stirrup
it?
Stirrup pumps. It's buckets of sand and stirrup pumps. That was the only equipment we had. But nothing ever happened there, fortunately.
So the idea was for you to get a fire very early.
That's right, yeah. Bucket of sand on it or a stirrup pump or something like that. But no, nothing ever happened at Dunstable. No problems were dropped.
Now back to Pafeli. What about kit inspections, that kind of thing? Did you have much of that sort of thing?
Yes, I think we did. You had to learn to put your kit on your bed, on your bunk, in a certain order. Everything had to be in a certain order, in its right place. And if somebody had stolen something, hard luck, you know, you had to buy another one. But yes, I think we did have kit inspections, probably every fortnight or so.
How much bull was there about, you know, the state of your shoes, you know, anything like that?
Yeah, quite a bit. You had to have shiny shoes. I remember doing that, polishing your shoes up overnight or anything, the next parade and the next day, especially Sunday parades. They put a lot into that.
But not excessive?
Not excessive for us, anyway. Whether the lower deck guys got any more than we did, I don't know. But we were doing an awful lot of swatting. We were learning all this stuff every day. You thought you'd got to go. Another chapter of the Oh dear.
Now, what did you think of your instructors and the way they taught you or tried to teach you? And how? What was their manner with you?
Oh, quite gentlemen. Well, I think it was mainly leading seamen or junior officers that were taking us. And it was like being back in the classroom, being back at school to a certain extent. They were trying to train us to think for ourselves and to use our initiative. And I suppose to a certain extent we did. And that was quite good. So I don't think we had an over excess of bull, not our slayers who were white capped. But.
What about getting out of camp? Were you allowed into Pafeli at all or wherever you might want to go?
The CW candidates only were allowed out at weekends. And we used to do Saturday and Sunday and go either into Pafeli or Borthagas or Crickets, another little town around there. And we used to find that I think it was the Women's Institute, or the great things there, invariably there'd be a Women's Institute hut where all these lovely old ladies would absolutely have tables and laden with jam sandwiches and things like that. And there was lots of tea and coffee and jam sandwiches available, all free of course, but that was all rather nice, the hungry young sailors. But I can remember Borthagas, that was nice, walking along the sand there and feeling a long way away from any war. We were just very quiet. And it was a nice place.
And how did you get on with the local population? It sounds like
didn't really meet any apart from these lovely ladies in the WI. I can't really recall a lot, you know. It was mainly stomp, 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 and learn in that camp. They really did. It was intense 8 weeks training.
Now, how did you do in your. You were in this special class, or, you know.
Well, I don't think we're actually rated then. We were just passed. I don't know whether anybody got to. I think there was one chap. Yeah, one chap left. He was very intelligent, but he was very roughly spoken, and he couldn't imagine him ever really being able to be a naval officer because of his appalling speech. But he was a bright lad, and I think eventually he trained to be an air gunner with a fleet air arm. He took that route, you know. And probably he was successful, I don't know, but I think he was the only one that actually left the class.
And this was after about 8 weeks, so we're talking somewhere around about January, possibly February, I suppose.
Yeah, that was right.
And what happened next? Where were you to go next?
Well, eventually we were allowed a week's leave after that, and then we had to report to Chatham Barracks. And Chatham Barracks, we had a special, the CWs were put in the Collingwood block at the back of the Gillingham, actually, the gate was in Gillingham. And we were put up there, and there were more classes for a bit. The only thing I remember about that, stupidly enough, was having a terribly sore throat one day, well, 1 week probably, and going into Gillingham and Chatham and trying to get throat lozenges. Because of the rationing, there weren't any about. You know, people used to buy throat lozenges as sweets. And nobody got anything. And I had this terrible sore throat. I could hardly swallow, and I was lumpy, you know, I couldn't enjoy eating. I was desperate. And the only thing I could get was a small bottle of Dettol, which is a very, very strong antiseptic. I got back to the barracks, and I put about three little drops of this Dettol into a tumbler and filled it with water and stirred it up, and I gargled with it. And hoped that would do the trick. Well, it did, actually, but it was so strong that it took all the lining off my throat, you know. It was terrible. I couldn't taste anything for about a week afterwards. It burned all my flesh and the throat. Anyway, that was a little incident of war. You couldn't get throat sweets or anything. The chemist had all sold out.
And what sort of training? Tell us a bit more about what was happening. Still with us?
Yeah, well, we weren't there long. We weren't there long. We were there possibly another 3 weeks at Collingwood Rock at the back of Chatham Barracks. Oh, and also Chatham Barracks, of course, you can't talk about Chatham without mentioning the tunnel. They asked you to ask the volunteers for firewatching duty, similar thing, you'd be given a block to patrol during the night for firewatching. And after a couple of days there, I used to volunteer for firewatching because if you didn't, you were asked to, well, in fact, you were instructed, you had to sleep in the tunnel, which was a huge tunnel, rather like an underground railway tunnel, cut into the big bank of the hill in Chatham Barracks, at the back of Chatham Barracks. And all the spare sailors in Chatham Barracks had to go into the tunnel and sling their hammocks in there and stay there until the morning sleep. That was our billet for the night, and it was awful because there was no proper air ventilation. It was stale, terrible smell, stuffy. And if you were late getting there, there was nowhere to sling your hammock because you almost had to go on all fours to get in. Because all it had was lion girders around to sling your hammock clearly on. And there were so many hammocks hanging up that you were hard put to it. You probably had to walk 100 yards into the tunnel before you could find anywhere to sling your hammock. So that wasn't very good. It was a very stuffy, smelly atmosphere. It was awful. But as I say, we were only there for matter of weeks when I was told, you had to do a joining routine there, of course.
What was that?
Oh, you had station cars. There were four watches. The yellow one, green watch or something like that. And you had a station card and you had to show that every time you went in and out of the barracks. That was checked. And the joining routine was collecting kits and little bits of kit you had to get. If you did the tropical kit and said you got sent overseas and things like that. And so they had extra things you could get there. And another little medical bits you had to go and have a teeth examined on it one day. And then there were working classes for the main lot, but because we were in Collingwood, we were just in classrooms every day. But after about 3 weeks, we were drafted. And I found myself with about eight other chaps. And we were all drafted to HMS London. So we were...
Still as a possible commission?
Still a CW candidate, yes. A CW candidate, yeah. And we went to Euston Station and got on a train, and I remember it took about 30 hours or more, 31 or 2 hours, to drive from Euston to Thurso. And it was all the wrong time, trying to get stopping. I think they had packed lunches, they'd let me get a packed lunch to eat on the way. But it seemed to go on forever, you know, it did. It seemed, it eternity to that journey.
Now, when would you have joined HMS London? Would that be about February or March, 43?
43, yes, it would have been. It would have been about March, 43, I would guess. It may have been, but it's already...
And where was HMS London?
It was at Chapel Close. And there were so many to-ing and fro-ing of ratings from ships in Scapa Flow from Furlough, which was quite a long way, you know. It's about half an hour's journey from Scapa Flow to the fleet in Scapa Flow, but not with even more, but a fair old way. And it was very invariably foggy. You could hear the big popcorn on one of the big headlands there near the Furlough. And eventually we were dumped onto a supply ship in Scapa Flow with our kit bags and hammocks. And we were sitting there, and we were told by our ferry officers to wait for a boat to come, a pinnace to come across from HMS London to pick us up. And I don't think they knew we were coming. We were sitting there for about 4 or 5 hours before a boat came and eventually took us back to HMS London, and we had to climb up a wooden ladder up the side of the ship. And they hauled their hammock and kit bag up on a rope, and we were installed in HMS London.
Now, what sort of a reception did they give you as a CW?
None at all. We were just part of the ship's company, we were just bundled on. And I was allocated Finsbury Mess, which was rather ironical. Each mess was named after the district of London. I was put in Finsbury Mess. And there we were.
Now, can you give us a little pen portrait of the HMS? So what type of ship was she?
It was a heavy cruiser. It had 4 turrets, A, B, X, and Y, twin 8-inch guns armament, about 6 twin 4-inch amidships each side, about 3 or 4 each side, twin 4-inch guns. Wherever there was space on the superstructure, they put an Oerlikon gun. And that was about it. We had torpedoes, 4 torpedo tubes, 3/4 way aft. There was an aircraft hangar for a Warus aircraft, the old Warus thing, but I don't think we ever actually had one on board. They used to use the aircraft hangar for some divisions in the service. And that was it. Well, within a week, we were on our way to Iceland, and we ran into a huge storm and lost the starboard gas chute. I recall that. The starboard gas chute wasn't there. We had to use the port one for the one.
Now, what was the storm like?
Well, quite rough. Quite rough. I mean, none of the lads were seasick. I think I felt a bit rough. I don't think I was actually sick. But my mate was we were just taken by a waiter from there, and somebody said, "Oh, well, that's your mess." And the Finsbury mess was round the main turret, or B-gun. And the British ships in those days, they planned them, and they put the guns in, and then they planned around the guns. The crew's comfort was not an issue at all. You were put where there was room and space. So Finsbury Mess had half a big gun turret going right through it, right down to the bows of the ship. And there were mess tables that were removable. They locked to the deck and they could be taken down for scrubbing the deck clean and put back again. But in this storm, we soon found that the ship, which was built in 1929, was past its sell-by date, and all the upper deck hatches leaked, so we had to get seawater spilling down onto the mess deck. And after 3 days of storm, we had 6 or 8 inches of water actually on the mess deck, sloshing around like a great tidal wave, and you had to eat and sleep and do whatever you had to do in that mess. And it was so overcrowded and bad that for about a week, I used to take my hammock onto the upper deck, and there was a cover under cover near the torpedo tubes. And I slept for about a week under the it's a tube car, because it was much preferable to being in this overcrowded, waterlogged mess there.
Well, there was another problem that I know, you know, the cockroaches.
Oh, cockroaches. Well, they were, I presume every British ship of that age had its ration of cockroaches, and there were millions of them. You just couldn't get rid of them. When we came back to Scapa Flow or in any port, the first thing to do was to try and get hold of as many old newspapers as you could and roll them up and set fire to them and try and burn out all the cockroaches, all the steam pipes which were running around the deck beds everywhere. Were crawling alive with cockroaches, millions and millions of them, couldn't get rid of them. And of course they'd be dropping onto the nest table when you were eating, and you had to watch out what was dropping down on you. But it was pretty awful, the living conditions on the land were pretty appalling.
What about the space you had? I mean, was it hammocks, I presume?
Hammocks.
Where were they hanging? What were the hammock routine?
You have steel rods welded to the deck heads about 3 foot down from the deck head, just over your head height, and you tied your hammock cleaners to those at a suitable distance, and you just grabbed hold of the bars and swung yourself up into a hammock at night.
Did you have any trouble at first with the hammock? Because that was probably your first time.
No, they're the most comfortable things to sleep in, actually. They really are. Once you got used to them, you had a bit of a pillow and your blanket, wrapped up in a blanket, and you just strip off your underwear and hoist yourself up, and that was it. You were away for the night. And then,
what about storage of hammocks?
Each mess had what they call the hammock netting. So you'd get a corner of the mess with a bar and with netting hanging down, and you had to, every morning, you put your blanket inside your hammock, unlashed it from the where it was hanging, put it on the deck, rolled it up, and you had hammock lashing, which was about an 8 foot long piece of siding. You tie it on one end, and then you sort of put a round turn and 2.5 hitch all the way around, dab it up like a sausage, and put it end down into the hammock netting. So all the mess stowed the hammocks there, and then got them out every night, of course.
And what about your kit? Or your main kit?
Everything was in your kit bag, and if you were lucky, you got a locker. There were certain passageways in the ship that had lockers, but I think the ship was used partly as a training ship, and I never got a locker. I was just to have to fish into my kit bag if I wanted anything out and stowed all that, you know. But some of the older ratings and the permanent ship's company, of course, they had the lockers and they were a little bit better off, they had more room. But yeah, that was it. It was general messing. We used to send somebody along to the galley to bring the mess, all the food back, whatever it was, in big trays and buckets or whatever, big mess tins, and serve it out on the table and eat it, and then take it back to the galley to be washed.
Did you have to prepare the food and that?
There were three types of messing. I remember, this was general messing on a big ship, you know, people were fed and they had work to do and they had cooks and special ratings to do the cooking. On a smaller ship, you had to prepare your food. It was canteen messing, I think they called that. You had to prepare your own food. You take it in turns, you know, groups of you on the mess, and you fill the spuds and cut the meat or whatever and prepare it or make pastry. On the fire, and you had to do it, learn how to do it from the older chaps that had done it before. And then you took it along to the galley, and it was cooked in the galley by the trained chefs. And then you would be there to eat it, of course. I think that's called canteen messing. And then on the very small ships, of course, on MTVs and things like that, everybody had to learn to muck in. I don't think they had a cook on there, you had to learn to do it and look after yourself.
And what did you think of the food? What sort of food would you get?
Filling, ample.
What sort of thing would you get for breakfast, lunch and tea? So, you know, give us an idea.
For breakfast, it was mainly just bread and butter. Big slices, big wadges of bread, you know, just to fill your stomach, get you going for the day. Tea, I think I just had bread and butter and tea for breakfast. And then it was fall in, you know, you didn't have very long. you get your hammer lashed and stowed, you get yourself washed, get your kit on, and have a quick breakfast, and then it was the bugle went and it was fall in the workstation.
So what about lunch? Or dinner, rather?
I don't think we had lunch. There was a... What did they call it? Up spirits, of course. That was at 11 o'clock every day, a rum ration. And
tell me about the rum ration.
The rum ration. Well, if you didn't take your rum ration, you got threepence a day extra, I believe, on your pay, something like that. But most of us had our rum ration because it was a vital. It was pretty vital, you know. It was so cold. We were doing runs to Iceland.
I'll pick that up. Yeah. Tell me, how did they issue the rum ration?
Oh, you fell in on the mess deck, and you just lined up. And you got a small rum ration on a big ship like that. It was grog. It was about four of water with one of rum. But if you got on the small ships, of course, it was two and one, or even a very small ship, you get neaters. And that was at 11 o'clock of the day, and you used to get a stand easy as well, a sort of 15-minute stand easy, a 10-minute stand easy or something, a break in work. So
how was it actually issued?
It was issued by a petty officer and a leading rating, and it was his duty to measure out. They had a big barrel of rum, and they had us measuring, copper measuring utensils that dished out one ration of rum or grog. You know, it would be mixed. It was a big ship, or barracks was always four and one as well.
And
you were supposed to drink it there and then, you know, you were supposed to down it. And that was it. But of course, a lot of the old stages used to save it up and bottle it for harder times. You know, you couldn't blame them really.
Did you do that, or?
No, I never did. I used to drink mine.
Now, what about the main meal? They must have had a main meal sometime. Do you know what it was?
As far as I recall, I think it was hands to dinner about seven-ish or something like that. Was it seven-ish? Oh, you've got me now, because it was all tied in with the watches. When you were at sea, well, even in harbour, there were watches going on, you see. Most of the time, it was cruising stage watches, which meant the ships coming in were split into three.
Well, explain that. Go through the watch system.
The watch system, as you probably know, went from midnight to 4 a.m. That was the midnight watch. Midnight to 4 a.m., that was the midnight watch. 4 a.m. to 8 a.m. was the morning watch. 8 a.m. to midday was the first watch. Midday until 4 in the afternoon was the afternoon watch. And then from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. would be split into two two-hour watches, which were the dog watches. You get the first dog watch or the second dog watch. And the reason it was split like that was because every day you change watches. So if you've done the midnight watch one night, you didn't do it the next night because of the dogs would turn the system round, and you'd alternate and go round the clock doing different watches. And I can recall being in my hammock sometimes and being awake enough to hear the watch being called and getting that terrible, oh God, feeling in your stomach, you know, you've got to turn out in the freezing cold. And then realising that they called the blue watch and you were red watch. And it was a lovely feeling to sink back in your hammock and know you've got another couple of hours to sleep.
So take me through a typical day from the start then.
Well, on the London.
When you were at sea,
CW, we were swapped around a bit and given all sorts of experiences. For one bit, I was in B gun turret as a communication number in B gun turret. And that's quite an experience. An 8-inch pair of guns fired when you're in the turret. And an awful vibration and a terrible smell of cordite. The stench of cordite is awful.
Tell me what your job was then. You were a communicator?
Well, they swapped us around. They used to give us...
Take them one at a time.
Well, on B gun, I was just communications. I'd get, the bridge would send out an order, train for the layer, the gun layer on the right, and the trainer was on the left. The trainer did the swiveling of the gun, and the layer did the elevation of the gun.
And how did you get these orders? I mean,
from from the gallery officers or one of his minnows on the headset from the bridge, you know, train so-and-so degrees and elevate so many degrees, and I'd pass that on.
And you got this through the headphones?
Through headphones, yes.